Today's program has been brought to you by Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie. Discover the best artisanal foods that America has to offer. Shop for more at manykitchens.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a very, very chilly day today in Brooklyn, this late November. So last week we talked a bit about Cheese 101. So today I'm really excited to talk about the most essential things you need to know about wine. That's the subtitle of Hello Wine, a new book out by Melanie Wagner. And she is a certified sommelier, a well-known speaker, teacher, and writer about wine based in Chicago. And she's on the line. How are you?
Good. Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. I love the book. It's a very handy sort of pocket-sized manual.
Thank you.
I was, you know, most of the wine books that I kind of conjure in my memory are these large coffee table books with like brilliant photography of vineyards and the close-ups of a grape. So this is actually very utilitarian, it seems.
Yes, and that was by design for mm-hmm. sure. I started out in the wine business knowing nothing about it, and people handed
about wine?
Me those. About wine,
yeah.
Yes, or the business of wine, really nothing.
Or books about wine.
Right. No, right out of college, I was a preschool teacher, and I moved to San Francisco, mm-hmm. and I was making $10 an hour and, you know, loving being with the kids, but it was during the dot-com boom, and I was just barely scraping by, you know, eating ramen noodles, watching this wonderful world of food and wine around me and not really being able to participate in it at all.
So not your average connoisseur or food.
No, not at all. And just kind of stumbled into it because I was having a conversation with one of the little boys in my class, his mom, one day on the playground, and I asked her what she did, and she said she sold wine for a living for a distributor, and she got to go all around the world and, you know,
fun.
Walk the vineyards and learn about wine and talk about wine every day. And it was like bells and whistles went off and the heavens opened up and I could hear angels singing. And I was like, yes, that is the job that I'm going to do. So I weaseled my way into a job with mm-hmm. a really great distributor, but I knew nothing. They gave me basically every account that nobody else in the company wanted. It was like 400 accounts in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Half of them were Chinese restaurants.
Uh-huh.
And but it was a great learning curve, and I think those were the books that people handed me when I first started out. I think the vice president of our company, you know, gave me the Oxford Companion to Wine, which is an awesome book that I can totally get lost in now.
Mm.
But at that time, it felt like a slap in the face. I didn't understand every
deep.
Other word, so it was way too technical. I wanted somebody to have a conversation with me, and I kept looking for that book, and I never found it. I was not at all thinking that I would be someday writing a book about wine, but as that painful learning curve kept happening, and I had all of these moments of interaction with wine snobs out there,
mm-hmm.
I think most people would agree that San Francisco is the, if not the, then one of the most sophisticated wine markets in the country, because you have producers coming down all the time. So I was selling wine as this bumbling idiot, you know, very enthusiastic, very curious, very happy, but bumbling idiot selling wines next to people who had been in the business for a long time, who were very sophisticated about it. And I was made fun of on a daily basis.
Oh my gosh.
I definitely cried, you know, more than one time. And I think I got down about it sometimes, but I always got back up, and I took that frustration that was building in me, and I started formulating my own philosophy on wine, and that is defending people who are just getting into it, or people who've been drinking it for a long time but have feel too awkward about it to really go any further. Maybe they're kind of stuck drinking the same thing, and they don't want to be, but they're intimidated to ask a lot of questions
or
in a wine shop.
Or to open those big books, and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I really, you know, it's like, guys, come on. If the end game is to get everybody drinking and enjoying more wine more often, then why would you be acting like this?
Right.
So that's kind of the idea for the book eventually was, you know, how can I give people everything they need to know in the beginning without being too technical? Editing was a huge part of what I did. You know, do you really need to know this in the beginning? Probably not.
The waxing poetic, like...
Yeah, I mean, believe me, I get a little poetic in the wine because I'm extremely passionate about it. And I do think that the appeal is... I mean, the appeal for me was the romance of it. The appeal for me, I think the first time I really fell in love with wine. We didn't grow up drinking wine in my family, but I got to go to Italy for 3 months and live with my friend from college who had grown up there in this little town, Ancona, on the Adriatic coast. And just to be in this small Italian town and see how they cook dinner and see that dinner wasn't like, okay, everybody eat as fast as you can and then let's get off to the next thing that we're doing. It was really the most important part of the day is to get together at the table at night. And people lingered, and wine was, it wasn't an afterthought, but it wasn't the focus either. It was just always there. It was an important part of the table. It was an ingredient. And so that was really, I was like, whoa, I really, really like this. I like this. I like what wine does, you know. Yes, it gives you a great little buzz, but also it's, you know, it inspires conversation.
And it's also communal because you have to get a bottle and share it around the table.
Well, you don't always have to share your bottle, but yes.
Yeah, there's something I feel a little weird about leaving something, you know, a bottle if I drink it by myself half open, or not, sorry, half full. And is that okay, by the way, if I take a red wine and put the cork back in? Should I put it in the fridge or
sure,
the counter?
Yeah, yeah. But I give a lot of practical tips about using wine. And yeah, that's
the
question
not as
that
good.
I get.
It's
that's a question that people feel bad about asking, but they ask it everybody at the end of class once they have had a few drinks. Then they start coming up with the questions that they thought were too silly to ask in the beginning. But all of those are answered in the book. But yes, how long can I leave a bottle that I didn't finish open? And that's part of that's a matter of taste. I think before I was in the wine business and was seriously evaluating wine all the time, I'm pretty sure I left a bottle on the kitchen counter for maybe a week or so and didn't really think too much of it. When I started selling fine wines to high-end retail accounts, eventually I got some good accounts, I wouldn't show a really great wine on the second day because I thought it changed so much from the first day to the second day. However, at home now, I probably could drink a bottle on the third day. But what I do is, like you said, put it in the refrigerator.
Okay.
Even if it's red, stop it up and put it in the fridge because that cold temperature is going to slow down the oxidation process.
Okay. Good to know. So the most important question of the day, of course, is what do I pair with roast turkey?
Yes. Okay. Well, if you were talking about roast turkey on its own, that'd be pretty simple because you could go so many different ways. But what we're really talking about is the Thanksgiving table, right? And
and
the smorgasbord of flavors that is, you know, what
gravy.
Wine is up for that challenge because there's
I mean,
there's
I
sweet,
see reds.
Savory.
People do reds, and then but it's white meat, so shouldn't it be a white? But then it's cold, so you want to drink a red? I don't know.
Okay. So what I would do, what I'm going to do, I'm not making Thanksgiving dinner this year, but my aunt is, and so I went wine shopping with her yesterday, and we bought some Zinfandels, we bought some Pinot Noirs, we bought some, we have kind of a lot of people coming, and we also really like to drink, so we bought some Zinfandels, we bought some Pinot Noirs, and we bought some Grenache, or in the form of Côte de Rhône. And then we also bought some pink bubbles. So sparkling champagne, you could do champagne. Our budget did not allow for champagne, rosé.
You call it pink bubbles?
Sparkling
rosé.
Wines
okay.
that are pink. Sparkling wines that are pink. Yeah, I mean, it's if you can afford to do something really nice, you could get a few bottles of rosé champagne.
What about a sparkling red like Lambrusco? Would that be good?
Yeah, that would be really nice too. Mm. I think the sparkling wines are kind of a nice alternative to white wine.
Yeah. Zinfandel, though, that's a good pairing?
Zinfandel, yeah. I picked the Zinfandel because for people who like really, you know, we got the, let's face it, a lot of guys in particular who want kind of this big, brawny, masculine wines, the kind of people who mostly only drink Cabernet. I got some really high octane, by high octane, I mean high alcohol Zinfandels for them from California. I think we picked up a Hartford, Russian River Ranches Zinfandel, and a Brown Family Estate Zinfandel.
Hmm. I never thought of Zinfandel for that. I got to try it. I haven't had it in years, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Zinfandel is intense, so you want an intense wine to be able to stand up to all the different flavors that you have on the table, especially the sweet stuff.
Okay.
And then you want a ripe wine. If your wine is too bitter or tart, like I wouldn't do an Italian red wine. That would sort of get clobbered by all the stuff on the table.
Okay.
And I wouldn't do a Cabernet because Cabernet has a lot of tannin usually.
It's too
and
bold.
Tannin is tannin. It just doesn't mesh with all the sweet stuff, especially on the table.
Uh-huh.
So ripe. And not a lot of tannin. So
ripe
Zinfandel
means like fruity?
Ripe as in fruity, yes.
Right.
Ripe tasting fruit. So I look for wines that when you stick your nose in the glass, when you taste them, the first thing you're going to taste and smell is big, ripe fruit.
Mm. Yeah, that does sound like a really great pairing for all those sweet potatoes and turkey gray stuffing.
Exactly.
That sounds
and
great.
And then Pinot is so versatile, but I would steer you towards more New World Pinot as opposed to Pinot from Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
So we chose some Sonoma Coast Pinot Noirs and some Russian River Pinot Noirs from Sonoma.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because one section in your book talks about the greatest division of all, actually, that would be the difference between New World and Old World wines. And you said they quintessentially taste different because, in general, New World wines are big on body and fruit, have lower acidity,
and higher alcohol.
Okay.
They're more extroverted, if you kind of think about it that way. I think that's the easy way to think about it. Old world wines, so wines made from places, you know, places that are old are places that have been making wine for thousands of years versus just, you know, 100 or so. And those places, their wines are generally more introverted tasting.
And they're subtle, so then there's...
So they're going to get completely beat up at the Thanksgiving table.
Oh, And you also said they're a little bit more earthy and sort of mineral in general.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Rather than fruity, I guess.
Yes.
Very interesting.
But if you think about subtle foods, then with subtle foods, those wines are a great complement. Like I would not ever serve Zinfandel with oysters, but I would totally go to the old world and break out some champagne or Sancerre or white Burgundy.
Huh.
Those wines would be beautiful with oysters because they've got that subtlety as well.
That's really good to know. And do you know why that is? The just like New World in general? Because there's so many different terrain.
There is. And I would say more and more it's becoming a little more convoluted and the world of wine is becoming more homogenous as our global economy increases, which is kind of a sad thing if you think about it because I don't know. I love to open a bottle and know that it actually tastes really authentic. And then there's definitely a side of the argument that says, yeah, but if it tastes good and I like it, why should I care if it tastes authentic or not? So there's kind of that argument. Why do I think old world wines in general taste more subtle? A lot of it has to do with irrigation and sunshine. Believe it or not, as simple as that. So in the old world in Europe, many, many vineyards in Europe, it is illegal to irrigate.
Oh, because so they have their own code
if it's,
of
so
laws.
That sort of limits where you can plant the grapes, whereas in the New World, there's no such
make it
rules
work
about that kind of thing. Yeah,
right.
So you've got people planting grapes in the central part of California where you've just got super duper amounts of sunshine all the time.
But not
grapes wouldn't
water.
Be able. Yeah, grapes wouldn't be able to grow there if you couldn't irrigate.
Okay.
So you've got basically grapes that are. That are making wine that tastes like it's kind of on steroids compared to the wines from the old world.
That makes so much sense. Huh. And but also, you know, new world wines are newer. The vineyards haven't been around for as long.
Yes.
So is that part of the difference?
I think that's part of it when you talk about the earthiness and the minerality that you can sometimes taste in wine because old vineyards grapevines
have more
that
mold?
Are old... The old guys, they've had longer to plant deeper roots. And also, if they don't have irrigation, their roots have to dig really deep to find water. And thus, they're pulling up, the theory is that they are, with their deep roots, they are pulling up the trace elements and minerals that you would find in the subsoil.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
so that's why if you taste true champagne, you typically taste chalk in your champagne. Or Chablis is the same thing. The Chablis region of France is very close to Champagne, and you get a very chalky, minerally flavor out of those wines.
Oh, my gosh.
And their soil is made of chalk.
Well, I'll have to look out for that with New Year's Eve. So, obviously, fascinating topics. We're just going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back.
Great.
You are listening to Same Old, Same Old by California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
At ManyKitchens.com, you can enjoy decadent caramel brownies, hand-picked teas, and fair trade coffee, oven-roasted chicken pot pies, and so much more. Whether you're planning a dinner party, sending a gift, or just want to try something new and delicious, Many Kitchens offers something for everyone. Help support small batch producers while you discover the best in artisanal foods from across the nation at ManyKitchens.com. Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie.
It's the same old song I've been singing too long. I can't sing it no more.
All right, we're back chatting with Melanie Wagner. She has a new book out called Hello Wine, The Most Essential Things You Need to Know About Wine. So one of the essential things I would like to know is, I hear all these different claims now and then about wine's health benefits. You know, one day they're saying, you know, drink a glass of red wine a day, it'll keep the doctor away. And so what is the most, if any, important health benefit?
Well, first of all, I'm not a doctor, so I try not to make too many sweeping claims about wine and your health, but I do a lot of research about it because people do ask me.
Yeah, I see it in the book, too.
Yes, and you know, overwhelmingly, people are very cautious to say drink alcohol because it's good for you because a lot of people don't drink it in moderation and then can get in trouble for
that. The cons outweigh.
But a little bit of alcohol, no matter the type, thins your blood. It's decreased chances for heart attack. It raises your good cholesterol. And then in red wine in particular, some of the good stuff like the flavonoids and the antioxidants in wine, you get a lot more in red wine than you do in white wine because red wine, the fermentation happens with the skins on.
Yeah.
So the juice has a lot more contact with the skins, and so you get a lot more of that in the finished wine. And one thing that I've been really interested in is this one antioxidant called resveratrol.
Mm-hmm.
Which you may have heard of, and there was a scientist at Columbia University who several years ago was very curious about resveratrol also and the heart healthy benefits of resveratrol. And he did a study where he went into his local wine shop and he just bought a bunch of wine off the shelf from all different places around the world. And he measured those resveratrol amounts in all the wines. And he found this very strange thing that all of the Oregon Pinot Noirs had like 50 times more resveratrol than the other wines.
Okay.
So he was really surprised. And he thought, okay, there's something to be learned here. So what he eventually found out was that resveratrol is a compound that is produced by the grape when the grape feels that it is being attacked by rot, mildew, mold. And so in Oregon, what you have is in the Willamette Valley especially, you have vineyards that are pretty much completely, overwhelmingly dedicated to Pinot Noir there.
Yeah.
You don't really, sometimes you find a little Pinot Gris, a little Chardonnay, but for the most part, they are all about the Pinot Noir. So you've got Pinot Noir, which has very thin, thin skins, some of the thinnest skins of
right.
all the grapes,
yeah.
and you've got a damp environment. So those grapes are sitting there just knocking up, they're knocking out as much resveratrol as they can. So not making claims because I'm not a doctor, but if you were interested in the antioxidant benefits of red wine, especially resveratrol, then I would say go
drink
buy
Oregon
Pinot Noir.
Very cool. Yeah, I saw that it had like cancer preventing stuff or who knows what.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And I also think that something that's sort of an immeasurable, intangible benefit of drinking wine, red or white, is wine has this ability to connect people. And like we were talking about earlier, my experience in Italy for the first time when I was 20 years old, it's that feeling of, you know, it really does help you put down your phone, your iPad, your computer, sit down and connect with people and talk with people and feel like you're a part of something. And I think that sometimes has more health
yeah.
benefits than anything else I can think of.
That's so true. I mean, I totally agree with that. It's so funny, though, because I thought you were going to say they're all probiotic. are they actually all wines?
Are they what?
Probiotic? Aids digestion? No?
You know, I don't know enough about that to okay. comment on it. I'm not sure. I would imagine because it.
Right.
I mean, wine is a living and breathing change as well.
Yeah,
as well.
It has that fermentation. I don't know.
You're gonna make me have to look that up.
All right. So, one thing I you know, when I'm in a restaurant or something, or somebody offers me a wine, you're supposed to taste it. I kind of go through the motions and play that part, like I'm swirling it, and then I'm smelling it, and then I'm looking at it, and what should I be doing here?
Sure, I go through a lot of the pomp and circumstance of wine, and definitely ordering from a restaurant there, that makes a lot of people nervous, the whole situation involving it. And so I go through that step by step. But basically what happens when the server brings you the bottle of wine you ordered, you want to check and make sure that it is indeed the bottle you ordered. And I have been...
That's why they're showing it to you and turning
yes,
it this way.
They're just,
okay.
They're presenting it to you so you can just say, yep, that's the one. And you can either just nod or you can say yes or it looks good or crack it open or, you know, whatever you want to say. So then they will open the bottle and they will pour you, the person who ordered the bottle, they will pour you a tiny little sip of wine. And they will also maybe present you with the cork. Now, you don't need to do anything with a cork. You can just set it to the side. You could ask them to take it away. You don't need to smell it, sniff it, you know, touch it. It
plug
really
your
doesn't
ear.
Tell you.
Okay.
No.
So sorry.
Just leave it alone. What really matters is getting your nose in the glass and taking a big whiff and smelling it. And you just want to make sure that the wine smells like wine, that it smells like fruit, that it doesn't smell like vinegar or dog poop or,
right.
you know, a basement or something. It should smell like wine. So as long as it smells like wine, then you're good to go and you can say, sure, it's good. And then the steward will start pouring for everybody, usually ladies first, and then he'll come back and pour you last. But the one thing that you probably want to be on the lookout for more than anything else is having a wine that's corked. So there's a lot of ways, unfortunately, that a little bottle of wine can go bad. And
right.
I outline some of those in the book, you know, what the smell is, how to identify
yeah, how
it,
do
what,
I...
to, what to do about
corked.
It.
Corked, okay.
So corked is sort of slang, and it's a little misleading, but it's corked means that the bottle has been infected with a chemical compound called TCA or trichloranisole. And a couple big problems with this. The first is that it infects one in every 12 bottles of wine.
Hmm.
So this is something that happens
it's
at the winery
often,
level
yeah.
usually, and
okay.
it gets in the cork or it gets in the wine. It makes your wine smell like musty, wet cardboard.
Okay.
And whenever I'm teaching a class, inevitably there's at least one corked wine that we have. So I always make sure I pass that around and get everybody to smell it and try to memorize that smell. Musty, wet cardboard or your grandma's funky basement.
Okay.
And I guarantee you've had one before.
Yeah. I guess I always thought it was an old world wine then.
Yeah. I mean, some old world wines are earthy smelling, but they won't smell like moldy and musty. Moldy, musty wine is one that's corked and flawed, and it should be sent back.
Okay.
The other huge problem with this is that people don't, like you said, you didn't know what it was. Most people don't know about TCA, so they just say, oh, they don't really like that wine, and then they don't buy it again.
Mm.
So,
Will you get sick from it?
You will not get sick.
Okay.
No, many people have drunk corked wine before and mm-hmm. you don't get sick. Your wine's just not going to taste fresh and, you know, like the winemaker intended it to taste, which is sad. So the protocol would be then to just say, the wine is flawed. Just be confident in it. Send it back. Don't feel bad because the restaurant doesn't pick up the tab on it. The winery actually picks up the tab. And the same thing with a retail store. If you buy a bottle of wine at a store and you go to drink it and it has that wet, musty cardboard basement smell, or it smells like anything else
bring
that you don't
back.
Like, bring it back.
Okay. Very good to know. Just tell me, because I know wine grape varietals are very fashionable. Sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out. What is the up-and-coming sort of rising star right now?
I don't know. I hate chasing trends. And you know what? It's funny because it's so hard to chase a trend in winemaking because when you plant a vineyard, you don't get good grapes growing off of your vines for 4 or 5 years. So people get in a lot of trouble doing that. I would say there's more of a return, just like in food right now, there's more of a return to heritage grape varieties.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Italy alone, there are 2,000 indigenous grape varieties. So I think whereas, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, you had people in Italy who were hurrying to plant Cabernet and Merlot and Chardonnay, what the wine industry calls international varietals,
right,
because people know those, they're easy to sell.
Okay.
I think there's a return of respect for indigenous grape varietals that have always been there and make beautiful wines like Aglianico from southern Italy that goes into making the wines of Terrazzi. Those wines are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Portugal, for a long time, they used all of their red grapes to make port, the fortified sweet wine, but now there's really a return to the old, old tradition of making still red wines from those grapes, and those are some of the most exciting wines that I've tried in a long time. If you like Cabernet, if you like a lot of tannin and big, powerful flavors in your red wine, but elegance also, buy Portuguese still wines. They're incredible right now, and they're like a fifth of the price of Napa Cabernet.
So it sounds like try to maybe go with a wine grape that has been growing in this region for a long time. It has a history in that place.
Heirloom grape varietals, if you will.
Very cool. Because, there's some varieties that can, I was looking through your kind of cheat sheet through the different common varieties like Chardonnay. So that's one grape that's very adaptable to many different areas. And that's why it's popularly grown so in so many different places. It's easy to grow, right?
Right.
In different places.
Easy to grow, and it's easy once it's in the winery, too. Easy to manipulate. You can make a lot of different styles of Chardonnay. You know, I love it when people say, oh, I hate Chardonnay, because I know what they're talking about.
Anything.
They're talking about one particular style of Chardonnay from California that's very, very creamy and buttery and oaky, but there are so many styles of Chardonnay, and I like that challenge because anybody who says they don't like Chardonnay, I can show them a Chardonnay I promise they'll like.
Wow. Yeah, because it's sort of a chameleon, too. And another one, which has seemed to have gotten a little bit of a bad rap, that's also in that category would be Merlot, correct?
Yes. Yep. Merlot is like a poor victim of the whole fashion thing. In the 80s, everybody was rushing to plant Merlot because it was the popular grape. Everybody could say it. It sounded a little fancy. And what happened was they went to rush to plant Merlot, but they didn't really do a great job of it. So what you ended up with was a lot of not so great $8 grocery store Merlot that had no character and was basically like,
oh my gosh,
you know, okay, plummy sipping wine,
so
but
maybe,
nothing special.
Maybe we shouldn't actually be drinking the next trendy grape wine, because it sounds like then it kind of weakens the quality.
Yeah, I mean, trendy, yeah, I would say stay away from trends altogether for sure when it comes to wine, but definitely always keep investigating and learning about new areas. And whenever you go to, you go to a small town who has really good food, ask about what their local wines
okay.
are as well.
Great.
And that's a great way to find special, unique wines that, you know, are not real popular, but have been there for a long time and go really well with foods.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a great place, great tip to end on. Thank you so much
for featuring the book. I hope that, you know, I hope that Hello Wine inspires people and it empowers them and makes them feel smarter and more comfortable with wine and helps them want to keep learning forever and ever, because wine is this big, beautiful thing and the learning never ends.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, for me. So check out Hello Wine, out from Chronicle Books by Melanie Wagner, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.